Support this podcast by supporting our sponsor, Elspelio. Get a Terra at Elspelio.com. That's the light that I use. Or you can get a Rescue SAR. The Lunatic is on order right now, but that is the most expensive light that they have. But you know what? The Terra, that'll get you there. So will a Rescue SAR. Go to Elspelio.com. And by the way, all orders, whether you get a light or not, any order of $300 or more at Elspelio.com will get you $20 off if you use the promo code podcast. Use the promo code podcast at Elspelio.com on any order over $300 and get $20 off. Elspelio.com. Get the greatest light you will ever own, the last light that you'll ever have to own. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. How you doing? Welcome to October. I went caving once in the past month. I went to Sullivan Cave in Indiana, very first cave I ever went to 10 years ago. And I took my wife and my sister-in-law and her girlfriend, and it was a great time. Just a little four-person group, kind of a mountain room and back out kind of trip. Although we did poke around in some of the dry areas in the older part of the cave up top, the rectangle crawl, the Grand Canyon, looked into the Scotto Grotto room. Great little trip. Last night I went camping with my 3-year-old for the first time. Little backyard camp. That was really fun. This kid, we stayed out there all night too. We got up and out around 6:30 in the morning, and he just had a great time. Oh, that is one of those dad memories that I hope I hang on to. Don't worry, I took pictures and I put them up on Facebook. A few of you are my Facebook friends, and you've already liked them. So that's really, really cool. That was fun. And he said he'd want to go camping in the woods. So maybe that's step two. By the way, thank you, Ian Chechet. Is that how I pronounce your last name? Anyway, Ian, I appreciate the email you sent in the middle of September. So Ian said, hey, you got to get the Caving Podcast on Spotify. And I said, well, yeah, I probably should. So the Caving Podcast is now on Spotify. Now, I just put it up this morning. So if you're listening in the morning or the middle of the day on the 1st of October, and if you click the link that I've got in the description and it doesn't work, it can take several hours for it to work. So just bear with me. The Caving Podcast is now on Spotify if you're listening later in October. So check that out. If you like to listen to podcasts on Spotify, you're all set there. This month's guest is Steve Davis, who was recommended to me by Rachel Saker, who was in the meeting of the Nashville Grotto that I did the presentation for. And Steve and I talked about all kinds of great stuff. We talked about TAG. We talked about the SCCI. We talked about Lechuguilla. We talked about some rescues. He was there on that that bad rescue or the recovery, I guess, at Valhalla back in 1984 when the rock fell and crushed the two cavers. So we talked about that. We got into that. I couldn't believe how much he shared on that. He was there. He aided in the recovery in a very, very big and real way. We just talked about a lot. And I can't wait for you to hear it. And speaking of Grotto presentations, I gave the presentation that I gave to the Nashville Grotto to the West Virginia University Student Grotto. That was really, really fun. Thanks to Sean Hogven and Ben Schaffler. Sorry, man. But that was a great, great time. And they brought some really, really great questions. And they extended an invite for me to come to West Virginia and do some real West Virginia caving. And as soon as I get time, guys, I'm coming over. I've been to West Virginia several times, but I've never been caving there. So I'm really looking forward to that. Oh, by the way, the Indiana Karst Conservancy, of which I am a member, is expanding their Shawnee Karst Preserve. And if you have got a little extra bread, you can donate to that Shawnee Karst Preserve expansion. And I've got a link in the description. So the Shawnee Karst Preserve was about a 17-acre preserve that they own, and they bought that, oh gosh, it wasn't even 10 years ago. Well, they're expanding that by over 50 acres. And, well, they need some help. So just go to ikc.caves.org and click the link there. Or you can click the link in the description. It'll take you straight to the Shawnee Karst Preserve expansion page. And you can contribute to that. We really appreciate it. Of course, it has, I believe, the largest population of the Indiana cavefish, the Hoosier cavefish, the Indiana cavefish, which is just slightly different from the northern cavefish. And it lives in Upper Twin Cave. And Upper Twin, I've been in it before. It is just a classic Indiana river cave. Great, great place. Worth preserving. Again, click the link in the description to contribute. And thank you in advance. Okay, let's get into it. Steve Davis, who has done everything in tag. And again, thanks to Rachel Saker for introducing us. And Steve, thanks so much for talking. I had such a great time talking to him. Here we go. Tag is probably a sorely underrepresented group for the podcast, so I'm glad I've got you. And I've heard that you've done it all in tag.
I've been around a long time, and so I have done a lot. There's not enough hours to do it all, so no one has done it all, but I've done a lot.
Well, where'd you start?
I started caving in 1976, organized caving with the Dogwood City Grotto in Atlanta, and my first wild cave, I guess, was Byers Cave on the Georgia-Alabama line, and it was a grotto trip, and I fell in love with caving then, and my second trip was to a cave called Tumbling Rock, and that's also a very popular, even today, a very, very popular horizontal cave, multi-mile long cave. And so I lived in the Atlanta area, and 2.5 or 3 hours to the caving country in Tag, and that was 43 years ago, and have been caving steadily since then. I don't go as much now as I used to. I cave vicariously through a lot of other people, but it doesn't mean I'm not as still just as passionate and care about the caving world and the caving community as I ever have.
Well, what have you seen like open up, I guess, over the years? I mean, an awful lot. I mean, people are still finding stuff every day, but were you close to people who made some really big discoveries? Did you yourself make some really big discoveries we may have heard about?
I know all the players in Tag. I've been around long enough, and all the big name people like Marion Smith and maybe Jim Smith and Gerald Mone and a lot of those guys. Yeah, we've all been involved with a lot of virgin cave exploration. One that comes to mind is a 308-foot pit called Mega Well, and I was involved with the initial exploration of that, which was kind of fun. It's still one of the deeper pits in Tag, and I didn't dig it open, but I was invited to go to the initial pit drop. And so we did that one, and that was years ago. There's just so many caves that I've been involved with as far as big-name caves. There's so many big-name caves that I'm trying to think. Just a few years ago, 3 years ago, David McRae out of Birmingham and myself spearheaded a group of cavers that reopened Lacey Pot. And Lacey Pot Cave is a little over 400 feet deep with consists of like two drops. But it was found in 1978. And 4 or 5 years later, the entrance collapsed and no one had been back since. But it was mapped, and there were two huge rooms in the cave. David and I decided to try and just lay siege to it and open it back up. And so we were successful with that. So that was one of the newer things that we did 4 or 5 years ago. But I've been involved with so many mapping trips and initial exploration through the years so most of the caves you'll have never heard of if you're not from the area. You know, they're all tag caves.
So would you say Are you working primarily in one state or the other? I mean, where are you based?
Well, I live in Jackson County, Alabama, and the reason I live here is because there are more caves in this county than in any other county in the nation. I'm fortunate enough to be able to live anywhere really in the world that we want, and I choose to live in this county because of the caves here. I live 3 miles from Georgia line and 8 miles from the Tennessee line. And that is TAG, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, do I spend most of my time in one state or the other? Really, no. I'm a preserve manager for the Southeastern Cave Conservancy, which I'm also a director and a founding member. But I'm the preserve manager for Howard's Waterfall, which is in Georgia. Tomorrow, my son and I are going over to Limrock Blowing Cave and work on the kiosk there. And so we're also going to stop by Tumbling Rock, you know, the second cave that I ever did 43 years ago. We're going to go by there and work on the gate. And I took my son up to South Pittsburgh Pit, which is in Tennessee. I took him up there Sunday. And so the TAG is really a true place for us, Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia.
And when you did that initial mega well trip, that to me just sounds, I mean, you know, you're a TAG caver, so you're a vertical person, of course. And and so, you know what you're doing there. But was that the first drop down mega well that, I mean, you didn't do it, but you were with the crew who did. Was that the first drop? Did they bring enough rope?
No, they didn't. There was a group of guys that were working on a sink that had water flowing into it, and they were in a flat out nasty belly crawl laying in the water, but with tons of airflow. So they eventually worked their way through a couple of 100 feet of crawling and came upon a big void. They had no idea how deep it was. And so it was just, it's 300 feet inside the cave. And one thing led to another, and they called me, and I had a 350-foot rope. And so we went on the next trip. The pit had all they had done is just seen the void, seen the hole in the ground. And we went there and set bolts. And it's not an easy thing to try and figure out where the best place to rig a pit. And there's lots of loose debris, and all of those, you know, rocks have to be pushed in. So we did all of that and set the bolts and rigged my rope. And one of the guys there, the initial discoverers, he wanted to be the first one down, which was fine with me. And the other couple of guys that were on the trip, they didn't want to do it. And so I said, yeah, I'm ready to go. And so I was the second one down mega well. And so Mike and I explored the bottom of the cave, and actually we saw most of the cave at the time. We didn't know it was all virgin. But the cave's only, I'll say, a couple of thousand feet long. And I guess it's close to 400 feet deep, because there's a couple of other smaller drops once you get past mega well.
I mean, so that's a pretty big deal. I mean, even in TAG, to find a 300-plus foot pit, that must have felt pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was really exciting. It was just part of the, that was back in the 80s, and it was in the heyday of exploration. People were finding long caves and new deep drops, and so this was just one. It was a deep one. It was deeper than, it's still probably the fifth or sixth deepest in TAG pit, but it was just one of another. So we did it and moved on. You know, the next weekend we're going somewhere else doing something else.
How much ridge walking do you do?
I used to do a lot of ridge walking, and I still do a lot. I find I've probably found 50 plus caves in Jackson, Alabama, Jackson County, which is where I do most of my walking. And 50K sounds like a lot, but it's because there's lots of holes to find, and you need to know where to walk and where to look. But there are, the ridges are just full of holes here. And so I go walking, not every weekend in the fall. It's difficult, getting more and more difficult because of hunting and the landowners doing hunting preserves. And so, which start in the fall, even before the leaves are off. And the only, really the only time to go ridge walking is after the leaves have fallen. And so it's like January or so before we can, the hunting season's close and we can go walking. But yeah, I go walking, not every weekend, but just about every weekend. I love doing that more than probably anything these days, caving related, looking for new holes in the ground.
And I mean, you know, January obviously is a good time to do it too, especially if it's cold enough. You can tell where everything is.
Well, the temperature really doesn't have so much to do with it as it does the leaves being off the trees.
Well,
and
I
all
just
of
meant
the,
like if it's if, yeah. If the holes are blowing, like if the pressure is just right.
Yeah. If the holes are blowing, they're not any easier to find, but you get more excited about it. And I have found a lot of blowing leads, and I have lots of blowing leads to give to the young guys who are looking for something to go dig on. Well, you know, I'll say, here, go dig on this one. And sometimes they turn into things and sometimes they don't. A couple of years ago, one of those exact things, a guy named Josh Schultz wanted to go work on a blowing lead. And so I walked over and I pointed to it, and I was almost embarrassed because it was such a little rinky dink hole. It just didn't look, it was like a football sized hole that just was nothing. And I was embarrassed to point it out to him. And so, so much so that I said, there it is, Josh, I'm going to go walking and looking for something better. I came back 30 minutes later, and they've got he and a couple of other guys have got the hole dug open, and he's screaming that it's a big pit. And so it wound up being a 153-foot pit that they dug open. So those are still out there, still around. We named that one Rayford Rift after the owner. Name is Rayford McCrary. And so Rayford Rift, naming the caves that we find are really fun. See if I can tell you a quick story. It was solo ridge walking a few years ago and found a good cave. It was probably a 100-foot pit or all, nearly that. And I was excited about it. And so since I was solo ridge walking, once I got off the mountain and back into cell phone service, I typed out a text and said that, I'm back off the ridge. I'm safe. Well, the guy says, did you find anything? And, you know, I wrote him back and I said, yes, I found a qualifier. I was doing voice recognition. And whenever he received it, it was koala fire, like a koala bear, and the word fire, koala fire. And he just laughed and laughed and sent text back. And it was obvious, well, that's what the name of the pit had to be, was Qualifier Pit. And so if you're looking at a bunch of goofy cave names and wonder, you know, why, it's because of stupid things like that. And last year I found one Flying Panda Pit. And they just, you know, Wet Boot Well. And one of my favorite names is, besides Qualifier, that was a really good one, is Guy on a Buffalo. Guy on a Buffalo Cave.
Where did that one come from?
Well, you can even do it now. Type in Guy on a Buffalo video. And we were watching this stupid, stupid video that morning before we went ridge walking. Somebody found it somewhere. And so, okay, we, you know, and I found a cave, and with guy on a buffalo, guy on a buffalo cave. And there's and on. Africa pit, because the entrance is shaped like Africa, the continent Africa. Yeah. And there's not, it just, these are, like I said, in Jackson County here, Alabama alone, there are some 2,500 known caves.
Goodness
so,
gracious.
So finding holes in the ground that are, they have to be 50 feet to qualify. And so it's not that hard. If you look,
the hard thing is just naming them, finding enough names.
There's plenty of stupid names out there you can come up with.
Well, isn't that something? I mean, you know, to be living in a place or near a place that where there are just so many caves all over the place, to have that luxury to just be silly about it and name it whatever. I mean, out here in Indiana, we've got a few silly named caves, but there are a little fewer and further between. You know, we've got, I don't know, just over 3,000 caves in the whole state. And, you know, you're close to that just in Jackson County there.
Yes. And well, that's 3,000 in the whole state is a lot of caves. You think of it a little bit differently, though. In here in Jackson County, there's some 2,500 known caves, like I mentioned. But in the whole state of Alabama, there are almost 5,000. So the whole rest of the state has the other 2,500 or 2,400.
Yeah.
And it just happens that Jackson County, Alabama is situated right in the limestone and the waterworks, so that there are a lot of caves.
So what, I know you've done some stuff in Lech, and I want to make sure that we get to that. But when you used to do a lot of exploration and you used to, you know, survey and map and things like that, what were some of the tougher trips, longer trips, things like that? How long would you expect to spend underground on a given weekend?
Well, all of the Lechuguilla is on a different level as far as difficulty and spending time underground. But for here, mapping trips are 12 to 14 hours, that kind of thing. It's the caves are not that long or that difficult. Of the 2,500 known caves here in Jackson County, there's probably less than 100 that are a mile long. And that's just a guess. I don't know. What I'm getting at is that it's kind of hard to spend 12 hours surveying a 2,000 foot long cave.
Sure.
But yeah, Lechuguilla put it onto a different level. So there's a couple of other things that came to mind. You mentioned vertical work, and yes, if you live here in Tag and if you're going to go caving, you pretty much have to learn vertical, because most of the caves in Tag are either start out as an entrance pit, or you go horizontally and don't get very far until you encounter a pit. So you do have to learn vertical. Early on, we was doing so much vertical. Some friends of mine said they were going out to Yosemite to bounce El Capitan.
Oof.
And so we took in 1984 or 85, I was very involved with an expedition, and we went out to Yosemite. We took two ropes out there. We took a 2,650 foot rope and did El Cap. It was the second time that El Cap had ever been done. But Half Dome, if you know what these monoliths are, Half Dome is a 2,000 foot cliff face, and it had never been rappelled or climbed before. So we took a 2,200 foot rope out there and hauled that damn thing up the backside of Half Dome and lowered it off the top and rappel down a 2,000 foot cliff face.
Oh.
and then proceeded to climb back up the rope. And so we spent several weeks out there doing rappelling and rigging and all of that stuff. Now I think they're done about every year or every couple of years. But
this is back in the 80s, you say?
Yeah, yeah, back in the mid 80s.
What was the permitting like for that, or did you just do it?
Oh, no, no. We had to get permitting similar to what the rock climbers were doing, that we just had to get a permit to be on the wall. Hmm. And that was about it. So it wasn't any big deal. But I think, too, the Park Service, they had no idea what we were doing, really. You know, it's kind of hard to explain. We have this really long rope and we're going to haul it up to the top. And but we did. And it was a blast. Just one of the highlights of my life. Is it really doesn't have anything to do with caving, but
it's
just
vertical stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was outside and, just spending 2 weeks on top of Half Dome near the top of Half Dome was quite an experience.
Oh,
a lot of fun.
My goodness. That'd be a dream trip right there. I mean, even if it doesn't have anything to do with caving, I had a friend, He did one of those. Well, I think he goes every other year or something like that to do.
Must be Chad McCain.
No, Dean Wiseman.
Oh, Dean. Okay. Yeah.
You know. Okay. You know Dean. Yeah.
I know Dean very well. I know all everybody.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you do. Dean knows a lot of people too. But there's that. I don't know, that collection of rocks at the top of El Cap. That's kind of like a cave. And so,
yeah.
Yeah. They're at the nose or whatever. And so he crawled in there and did that. And, he did our presentation. He said, technically there's a cave, I guess, kind of up here.
Well,
so
depends on what, California, says how long a cave has to be.
Yeah. It wouldn't count in Jackson County, Alabama.
That has to be 50 feet. But ironically, right over the line here in Georgia, it only has to be 30 feet.
Interesting.
So, yeah, well, that's just whatever cavers decide to, whatever criteria they want to use.
Yeah.
It's just cavers that are making that up.
So, I mean, I fell in love with caving out here in Indiana, and it's a lot different. We don't have the vertical extent that you guys have. Our deepest pit is 142 feet or something like that. And, you know, you found 153 footer just on an afternoon. I'm sure that's not the only one you've found. So
correct.
It's a different kind of experience. You know, I caved for like 4 years before I even touched a rack, you know, before I did anything vertical. So that's what I fell in love with. And I do like doing vertical. You know, I like, you know, bouncing the usual pits in Indiana, most of which are just shy of 100 feet. But, yeah. But
that's respectable. It is.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I mean, like, I don't know. I get into it when there's some crawling and, you know, there's a lot of wet stuff here in Indiana. There's wetsuit caving and things like that. How much of that have you done, or do you kind of steer clear?
No, I don't steer clear of any kind of caving. Well, I do now. I didn't back it for years and years. We have lots of what we used to call them multi-drop wetsuit caves, but these days people just call them wet multi-drops because so many people are wearing cave suits and not wearing wetsuits, although they are wearing some thinner wetsuits these days that we didn't have access to back in the 80s and 90s. My favorite kind of caving is following water to the bottom, some of a 500 foot deep system. Mm. And those are most of the multi-drop systems start out at the contact and they go underground vertical 400 to 500 feet till they reach the water table. And so there are lots of those caves out there. And I can't say I've done most of them, but I have done a lot of multi-drop wet caves from one end to the other. And it's kind of funny now that I'm 62 and I'll have people will, you know, they're asking questions. Well, you remember Fowler 2 Cave and on the third drop, there's a crawl. And I'm thinking, I did that cave 30 years ago. And okay, so I did it four or five times to get all the way down to the bottom. But there's a couple of hundred other wet caves in between there. So no, I don't remember that particular drop. But some are there. I will say that most of the multi-drop wet caves here in Tag are similar in the fact that there's water flowing through them, and depending on how the time of year is, how much water is flowing through them, and also that determines how either how far or how dangerous you want to make the trip. And they're all 3, 4, 5, 6 pits. Some have as many as 8 shorter pits. It's boom, 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 kind of a sewer system that gets you down to the valley floor. And there are lots and lots of those caves in Tag, so many so that you can't do them all.
No.
So you do the ones that are famous, the ones that people talk about and the people enjoy doing.
And for you, which ones are those? I guess I want to get to like some of your favorite recreational trips.
Multi-drop systems, by far, wet systems by far are my favorite ones. And the typical classics that are known, Guy's Cave is one. Fowler number 2 is another, and Elmo's Canyon, and an interesting cave, James Harry Smith Cave. The Northerners know it as Norseman's Well.
Ah, I was just about to ask about that. Yeah.
That is a beautiful, wonderful cave, and it's very well worth doing. And I can name dozens of these multi-drop systems. Some of the best ones are pull-down trips like McBride's and Prior Spring and Deep Thrust. Those caves are, and the Boulder entrance to Sinking Cove, those caves are pull-down trips. And so you don't have to fight the water climbing back up. And so those have their own fun. They're just great caves to pull down.
Why do the Northerners call it Norseman's Well and you call it, well, I can't even remember what you said you called it.
It's a long story and I don't think you want it on your podcast.
that's too intriguing. So
let me say it this way. Let me think about it just for a second. Some guys came down and were ridge walking. I don't know if they're Indiana guys or from Missouri, but they ridge walking and they found the big cave system. And it's a really nice entrance pit, really nice cave. Well, they were exploring it. And this is the way I understand the story went. They told somebody that lived here in Tag, kind of a ha ha ha, we found a big new system and we're not going to tell you where it is because we're still exploring it. Well, that was enough for somebody to drive around and find where they had parked their vehicles. And so went and found the cave like the next day or two when these guys had to go back to back up north. And so they found the cave. It had already been explored, but it had not been turned in to the Alabama Cave Survey because the Indiana guys knew that if they turned it in, then it would be open season for the local cavers, the Tag cave. So they didn't turn it in. So the rule is if you find a cave and you turn it in, you get to name it. So it was turned in as James Harry Smith Cave. And I'll tell you sometime why that name was picked out, but not here.
Okay.
And so its official name is James Harry Smith Cave, and it was shortened to JHS. So, of course, the Northerners who were exploring it and mapping it were, you know, they jumped up and down and said, how unfair is it that the, you know, local guys are, doing this to them? And so somewhere in the years, it got switched over to Norseman's Well, which is is a better name for the system. Although, if you read the words, it's Northman's Well, and that is kind of a slap too. So it's not, but it is a better name. And I, you know, the funny thing is that that was, I don't know what, 30 years ago. Nobody cares today. All that stuff is all over and done, and all the guys are old and not caving anymore. And so all the new guys just get to go enjoy Norseman's Well, and which is, it is become known as Norseman's Well because it's a better name than JHS Cave. That happened quite a bit. People would go secretly find a cave and start mapping it, exploring it. And if it was a really nice cave, somewhere along the line, it would leak out and other people would want to go check it out as well. And so if the other group, the second group, finds it and turns the coordinates in, you know, they get to name it. And so there are several caves throughout TAG that have dual names because of that.
You're with a lot of grottos. Can you name them off? At least the ones that you're active in. I mean, you can be a member and get the newsletter and whatnot. But who are you active with?
No, and I'm not active in any of them.
Really? Okay.
I live here in Jackson County, and I don't want to say involved, but you know, with the Dogwood City associated with the Dogwood City Grotto, the Clock Tower Grotto in Rome, the Chattanooga Grotto, and the Birmingham Grotto and the Huntsville Grotto. Those are the main ones. I just know most of the players, the active cavers that are involved with those grottos.
Dogwood City put on the cave-in?
The Dogwood City Grotto, yeah, the Atlanta puts on the cave-in every year, which is the largest caving event of its kind in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the biggest one I've ever been to. and you started the bonfire?
Well, I was at the third annual cave-in was my first one, and you know, back then there was only a very few hundred people there. And so, yeah, we would go, one of my dear friends named E.T. Davis and another one named Chuck Canfield, we would go figure out how to get wood for our Saturday night bonfire. And so sometimes we would usually that weekend before go off into the woods somewhere and cut dead wood and put it in the back of our trucks and haul it over. And so every year we would try and, you know, better the last year. And so we were building better bonfires. And then a guy named Buddy Lane, who lives in Chattanooga, he was cutting some pine trees off out of from in front of his house. And he wound up with like two tractor trailer loads of trees, and we talked him into donating them to the Tag Fall Cave-In. So that year, and I don't remember what year it was probably like the sixth or seventh annual, really early on, but we had two truckloads of wood to cut up and build a bonfire with. And so we, every year after that, I think it was probably two, because the Dogwood City Grotto was making enough money off the cave-in that we could afford to buy scrap oak wood. And so we would get two truckloads of scrap oak. And scrap, these are still big, full trees. They just have crooks and notches in them that makes them not good for cutting planks and boards out of. So we started from there, and even till today, it's amazing how far it's come. Back then, we were just stacking wood however we could, and we started doing the log house kind of thing and making a – because we could make a log frame and just dump logs into it, cut-up logs. Well, today they use a knuckle boom and five or six guys with chainsaws, and we were lucky if we had – one chainsaw and one axe. but anyway, yeah, it was a lot of fun. A lot of big stories to tell with all of those bonfires. We also incorporated fireworks with those bonfires.
I remember that part.
I think it was maybe the 10th annual. It might have been the 10th. We wanted to do something really special and really big. And so we had a bunch of fireworks that we had them laying out on the ground, all kind of staged and ready to go. Well, somehow those fireworks caught on fire themselves. And so this big, huge, just show of fireworks going off in the grass all around behind the bonfire. And E.T. and Chuck and I were all just confused and running around trying to figure out how to stop this thing from going, just using up all of our fireworks in one time. But we looked over and the crowd was just going crazy. They thought that was all planned and it was just a great thing. But I never will forget that the three of us were all just terrified and we didn't know how big it was going to get. But the crowd was just loving it, as typical.
Are you, were you ever like involved in grotto leadership and putting the cave in on and that whole organization part of that? Were you ever sort of integral in that part?
The bonfire was an official thing. And so, we were named in all the books and all of that that was part of my job. But I was back during that time, I'll say all through the 80s, I was so involved with the Dogwood City Grotto that the cave-in was, everybody came together and we did whatever we could. I may not have been an official named person, but we helped. Back then we put on a dinner and you would pay money. And so we had a bunch of cavers that would cook dinner. And so we would go the few nights before, we'd have to go, buy the chicken and buy all the lettuce for the salad. And so, we were all involved with doing all of that stuff. So, but as far as, if I was, like the treasurer or, the editor of the guidebook, no, I didn't. My name was always, Bonfire crew.
Bonfire technician.
Yeah, so, that was about, I think that might have been what it was. The E.T. and Chuck and I were always, until like the 15th or 18th and annual, and then other people started getting involved and taking over some of our chores. Along with the cave-in and caving, the rescue work.
Yeah.
Was a big deal. And if you ever did as much caving as I did, well, all the good guys were also involved with the cave rescue. And back in the 80s, it was just a bunch of capable guys, good cavers, that would go and rescue people if they needed it. And if I ever needed rescuing, I didn't, thankfully, but I would have expected and hoped that those same guys would be in there for me. But I was involved in quite a few rescues and recoveries through the years. One of the darkest days of my life, period, was Valhalla.
Yeah.
And it was in 1984.
Yeah.
I was there that day. I was the last guy to see these three young Georgia Tech students alive. I talked to them at the top of the pit. I led another group there. There was a bunch of us there that day, and I led another group. But they had the best rig point, and I was wanting them to hurry up and go do their thing, so we could rappel down beside them. But I asked them, could I use their rope and to rappel down with them? And I said, sure. So I get down to the bottom and we're talking. I'm telling them how to get to the rest of the cave. my group was just going to bounce the pit, but they wanted to go do the cave. So I talked to them for 10 or 15 minutes, and other people are rappelling down. And so they leave to go caving, and then my group, we bounce the pit, and everybody gets done. And I go home that night. And I guess 11 o'clock Sunday night, I get a phone call and it says there's, you know, and something going on at Valhalla. And I'm thinking, well, damn, I was just there. And so I get up there, and I find out that it's two recoveries, that two guys died. And it was, the three that I had talked to. Well, two of them are dead, and they are under this huge train car size rock at the bottom of the pit. And I know all the people up on the top, and we're all, trying to figure out. I live in Atlanta, so 3 hours away, the recovery operation is already well in hand. But I never will forget going down to the bottom. We couldn't find one of the guys. And so we're digging around up under the big rock, and we finally find the second guy. He was completely under the rock. And so we had to get him out, and we couldn't get him loose. And so several of us were moving rocks up under this body. We had to do that to get him out. And we eventually moved enough stuff, and we got the body out. And so the two bodies, they go up to the top, and then there's three or four of us left on bottom. And I start climbing. Valhalla is a 227 foot pit. And I start climbing, and I'm dead dog tired, because it's probably dawn by now. I don't know, but I'd been caving all that Sunday, and drove home, and then drove right back up to Valhalla. So I hadn't had any sleep, and then working on all that very emotional stuff there. And then start climbing up the rope, and I'm tired, and I sit there, and I never will forget the feeling of sitting on rope, resting, looking around the pit, looking down and looking up, and really no one else. You're kind of in your own world. And I remember thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Why do I do this? Why questioning everything?
Yeah.
And it was I remember that as one of the darkest days of my life, sitting on that rope and the stuff that happened before that, because I'm not a trained EMT. That kind of stuff is not things that I see every day or every year or ever. And so it has stuck with me all of my life. Whenever I got up to the top of the pit, most everybody had gone. Things are changed now, but back then, once the bodies are recovered, well, everybody just kind of fades away. And it was just, I couldn't even get a hot cup of chocolate that morning. But I will say it was one of the darkest days of my life, but I would not change it for anything. I was glad I was there. I was glad I was able to do what I could to get those guys out, because it was something that had to be done, and we did it.
I mean, I've heard about that so much.
People have.
Yeah. And that was just a freak accident, right? I mean, rock just fell.
That's right. It's kind of like walking through the woods and a tree falls on you.
Yeah.
A dead tree. How often do you hear of hikers getting killed by a falling tree?
Never.
I mean, it's just never. And that's the same thing. It's just unbelievably crazy circumstances, of a train car size rock falling off the wall. And I've been caving long enough that I know of several rocks that have fallen in different caves that, you go back to a cave and you say, you know, that rock wasn't there before. It was laying over on its side, and now it's flat on the ground. How did that happen? So, you know, we see those, but that was a very, to have cavers under it when it fell, it was just unreal. It was.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a difficult time. I don't know how much of this stuff you want to hear, but
all of it.
Ellison's Fantastic Pits, the deepest pit in continental United States. Well, there have been several rescues there as well. And one of my stories that I tell every now and then is there was a guy named Bill Putnam who broke his leg. And that is a harrowing story in and of itself. There was just two of them, and they were surveying. And Bill did something and slipped and fell and broke his leg. Well, there's just two of them in the cave. They're almost 1,000 vertical feet below the surface. And so the guy that's got to go to get help leaves all of his food and water and stuff with Bill. And I have to imagine that Bill is wondering the whole time, well, I sure hope Dave doesn't slip and hurt himself.
I know.
Bill says that he was prepared to wait for 12 or 14 hours, and sure enough, that's what it was. So on that rescue, I got to the top of the Fantastic Pit, and Buddy Lane was there, and we were talking about trying to figure out fastest way to get the stretcher with Bill from the bottom of the pit up 500 feet. And frequently we would use a 4-to-1 haul system or a 3-to-1 haul system. A 4-to-1 haul system is up a 586 foot pit. That means these guys have got to haul a couple of thousand feet of rope and pulling him up. So what we decided to do was I got on rappel and I rigged a rope that was tied to the stretcher. It went up into the attic through a pulley and then came back down to me. I tied that rope onto my seat. And the idea is we would do a counterbalance thing. Well, me alone, I don't weigh enough to pull the stretcher and Bill up. So I had to get somebody to hang below me as excess weight while I rappel down the rope and raising the stretcher. So we'd never done that before. That was just kind of an on-the-fly thing that Buddy and I dreamed up. And we ran the numbers, and we figured, well, it'll work. It will work. So I got a guy and that hung below me. That in and of itself is crazy. But so we're rappelling down Fantastic Pit. We get about halfway. Well, here comes Bill. And he's coming up, and he's slowly rotating around, and he's far enough away that I can't reach him to stop him from slowly spinning. But I stop, and I said, hey, Bill, and you all right? And he said, who is it? And so I told him it was Steve. And he said, oh, hey, Steve. And, you know, so we're having this chat halfway up Fantastic Pit. He's in a stretcher, and I've got somebody that's below me that doesn't know Bill. And so we you know, tell him that, you know, it's going to be all right. We're making this thing happen. I rappel on down, and he rises up to the top, and they get him off. And so that's how that rescue happened. And it was just an amazing thing. Well, to finish up the story, about 4 years later, almost the exact same thing happened. There was another person that had broken their leg, and I get to the top of Fantastic Pit again. Well, and there's Buddy standing there. And he said, Steve, I'm glad you're here. We're going to do the same thing that we did with Bill. And so, you know, okay, all right, that works great. It worked good last time. It'll work again. So I'm looking around for somebody that I trust that's going to hang below me. Well, who do I see but Bill Putnam? And I say, Bill, it's your turn, buddy. You're going to hang below me. And he said, oh, hell no. And so I had to say, look, you know, this was we did it for you, and you we've got to do it.
You owe me.
And so, yeah. Well, it's not me. He owes the rescue people.
Sure.
Sure enough, I put Bill below me, and we did the rappel thing. That one was a little bit different. For some reason, they had radios down at the bottom, and for some reason, the stretcher didn't go all the way up to the top. So I was on bottom, Bill and I were on bottom, but the stretcher was 10 or 15 feet from the top. So he and I, Bill and I, had to do changeover, and so I'm climbing up the rope, but we're not going anywhere. We're just kind of on the bottom. Bill is right below me, and we're climbing, and that way the stretcher rope is raising. Well, the next thing I hear is, I don't know if you've ever done Fantastic before, but when rocks fall, they reach terminal velocity and then some, and you can hear them falling from a long way, and they keep getting louder and louder and louder. And so I'm on rope and I hear a rock falling. and yeah, it's going, oh, and it's just, I can't go anywhere. And then all of a sudden, and it echoes, reverberates throughout the pit. And I'm yelling over to whoever's talking to Buddy at the top. You know, I'm yelling and screaming, stop knocking rocks. And I hear another one. Here it comes. I can't go anywhere. So I look down, and Bill is hiding under his helmet, under my feet, and not doing anything. And so I start kicking Bill in the helmet, saying, move. And what I'm wanting him to do is go horizontally. I know that we are right above the rock fall, and if we can get even 20 feet away, we'll be safer. Bill's not moving. And, here comes another rock. And all you can do is hide under your helmet, knowing that if it's a – and I have no idea knowing how – these were either egg size or maybe baseball size rocks. But they certainly would have killed us. Helmet or no helmet, we would have died. But fortunately, about four or five rocks fell. Buddy's over there apologizing on the radio, and the guys are over there apologizing. You know, and I'm thinking, I don't want to hear any apologies. I don't care. Stop the rocks from falling. And then I'm telling Bill to swing us over out of the way so that we won't get hit. So that was another one of those times, 2 or 3 or 4 hours after the patient gets out and gone. And by the time we get there, well, all of the county people who were there that brought food and all that stuff, well, they're all gone. And, you know, I'm looking around for just something. I'm hungry and all that, and you can't find anybody. But fortunately, that type of stuff has changed. But lots of rescue stories.
I mean, I've heard a lot of rescue stories talking to people on the podcast. I've talked to I've got Anmar Merz on my list. Indiana guy. And I've talked to Don Paquette before. I had him here at the house, and a lot of rescue stories. And you know, some of them are funny, some of them are grim. Yes. But they're all good. They're all worth hearing.
Yep, they are. There was a mock rescue at Tumbling Rock Cave, and since I'm a director of the Southeastern Cave Conservancy, I asked if I could be just take pictures of the, not be part of the rescue, but just be there and take pictures of the mock rescue. So they have the guy in the stretcher, and they're hauling him through the cave, and they're doing their routines, and everybody's practicing. And I know the cave very well, and I'm right there with the stretcher, and we're probably 1,000, 1,500 feet from the entrance. And at one point I have the camera around my neck, and I go to take a step across a couple of boulders, and I realize that my camera is going to crash into the boulder because it was around my neck and it's swinging out. Oof. And so I stop myself in midair, and I fall. And I fall about 5 feet and land flat on my back in some sand, and it knocked the breath out of me. Well, the good thing and the bad thing is that I was right at the rescue stretcher with 20 other people. They happened to see me fall. And the guy jumps down, and I don't know who it was, but he jumps down and he said, Steve, are you all right? And I had the breath knocked out of me. And I said, I don't know. Give me a minute. I never got my minute. Oof. The guy says, oh, look, hey, we got everybody stop. We have this real rescue. And I'm thinking, oh, hell, I don't want to be part of a rescue. You know, I don't want anything to do with it. I just had the breath knocked out of me. Give me a minute. I'll be okay. I'll walk out. And the guy is saying, look, we have to haul somebody out of the cave. It might as well be you. And I realized then that I'm not going to win this battle. I'm not going to be allowed to walk out of the cave under my own power. They're going to put me in the stretcher and take me out. And sure enough, they did. They put me in the stretcher. Well, I'm realizing I know half of these people that are going through, and I'm hearing later that they had no idea. All they heard was that I fell and was hurt. And so they had no idea how bad I was hurt. Well, I'm chatting and joking, and my back hurts, but I mean, I could have walked out under my own power. And I know these people that I'm looking up from the stretcher, seeing their faces, and you know, and, hey, Dan, how are you doing? And he said, you all right, Steve? I said, yeah, I'm okay. Well, that really confused them, because they were trying to, you know, well, it's a real rescue, and but he seems like he's in good spirits. And so, but that was, so I was, I guess technically rescued one time, but, I don't like to count it, because, the stretcher was already in place.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't have to wait there for hours like everybody else who's ever had to be rescued.
Hell no. And I would have walked out. So you ask about Lechuguilla. Lechuguilla, Buddy Lane was going over there. Had been a couple of times, and there was it was in its early years. It was like 20 miles, maybe 15 miles had been explored. And Buddy, I talked to him one day, and he said, you know, you need to go out there. You need to go. They were looking for people who were vertically proficient and who were, I don't want to say hardcore cavers, but who could last for 18 hours, do a good hard 18 hour trip. And so Buddy was saying that, yeah, you could do it. You can do it. And so anyway, I went out with him on the first expedition out there. And so, and then I never looked back. I love Lechuguilla. It's a fantastic cave. I've made over 20 trips into the cave, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who've made a lot more than that. But it was, for me, it was in the heyday of the just running, finding virgin cave everywhere you wanted to look, and such fantastic, beautiful formations everywhere. And it's just an amazing, amazing place. So I thoroughly enjoyed every minute. It's again, Lechuguilla is one of the highlights of my memories.
You think you'd ever be able to go back? I mean, they're taking so long to get to the frontier anymore.
If I were physically fit, yeah. I mean, if I were physically fit, yeah, I think I could do the cave. But will I ever be that fit again? I doubt it. So I'm not holding my breath. I'm 62, so I'm not holding my breath that I'll ever be able to go back there. And I'm okay with that. I can't remember now who did it. I'll think of it later. Somebody did a really excellent video of Lechuguilla. It brought back a lot of memories, and I thoroughly enjoyed those. So I'm okay being a armchair caver as far as Lechuguilla is concerned. I did a lot of stuff there and a lot of good memories. Let other people push the limits. But it's maybe, if you're asking in my heyday, yeah, I would be pushing the extremities of the cave just like the guys are now.
So you're a director with SCCI, founding member too. And, you know, everybody I ever talked to about SCCI, they're like, it is so worth joining up, being a member. I mean, you don't have to be a member to get access, but it's certainly nice. And it's just one of the most, I don't, you guys have so many properties. You have control over so many caves and you protect so much of the karst down there. And not just down there. I mean, all over the southeastern region. I don't know. I guess I don't even know what I'm asking. I just.
What happened?
What happened? Sure. Happened? Why not?
I won't tell the whole SCCI story, but it is an interesting story. And today we are continuously looking. I am also the acquisitions chair, and that's one of the roles that I serve for the SCCI. And I'm always looking for property. There are so many caves that we can't buy them all. And people get frustrated occasionally because we do say, well, we just can't spend $50,000 on this cave, on this 200-foot long cave. I'm sorry, but we got to save our $50,000 for something else. And so we get beat up a little bit by that. But we've been very lucky that most of the caves that we acquire are nobody else wants them because they're on up on a mountainside. I think of Valhalla, for example. I mentioned it earlier. And the only thing that the property surrounding Valhalla is good for is hunting land, deer hunting, or timber. There's nothing else you can do with it. And so that land is just not worth a lot. So we've been very fortunate to pick up caves here and there. We have expanded. We've got several properties in Florida. We've got Cyclops we announced earlier this year Virginia. We've got Dalio, which is part of the Roppel system, which is part of the Mammoth Cave system. And so in Kentucky, we've got a couple of other properties in Kentucky. And then in Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama as well. I can't say enough good things about the SCCI, the people involved with it. Yes, I'm a founding member. And maybe that's just it started in the Atlanta area, and somebody wanted to donate a cave to a group. He didn't want to keep the cave. The cave was being closed, and so he wound up buying it. But he said, I don't want to own this thing. I don't want the liability. You guys need to come up with an entity. And so I was happened to be in the living room whenever we figured it all out and invented the Southeastern Cave Conservancy. And I am a founding member and have for the past 6 years been a director. We've instituted a rule now that you can only serve 2 3-year terms consecutively. And so I'm in my last year of my term. So next year I'll have to sit out for 3 years. I'm okay with that. That does allow newer young people to come in and get involved with the SCCI. We found out that it was very difficult for people to compete against some of us who were founding members and were still directors, Chris Green and Buddy Lane, for example. They've been directors from the very beginning for 25, 27 years. And so no one is going to come in and kick them out of their seat, vote them out. And so we decided it's time for some of us to step down. And so we instituted the two-three-year term thing. And it's good. It's kind of scary because this will be Buddy Lane is first time ever off the board. He cannot run again. And reason I'm thinking about it now is that we had elections. And so Buddy's term will end in a couple of weeks. And same way with Bill Stringfellow, has been on it since the beginning, and he can't run again either. So he's going to have to sit off. The good thing about those two guys is that Bill Stringfellow is our secretary, so he will continue to be involved with the SCCI. Buddy's our treasurer, so he will still continue to hold that role. He just won't be able to be a director, and I'll still be if they want me to, I'll still be acquisitions chair, after I'm not a director anymore.
What do you want to say to the caving community? What needs to be done, or what do you think needs to be said?
Well, as far as the SCCI, I live and breathe the SCCI these days, and I don't believe there's a better entity for cavers to donate their money. There's not a better place because we do buy caves and we protect caves for perpetuity. And you are long gone, the SCCI will still be here, and the caves that we have purchased or acquired today will still be around. And so that's one of the probably the big thing that I would really like for cavers to know is, if you don't know who the SCCI is, look us up, find out who we are, and look at some of the caves that we do own some of the best caves in TAG are owned and managed by the SCCI. And we're not some big corporation. We're just a bunch of cavers. And that's always been kind of funny, is that we're just a bunch of cavers trying to save caves for everybody else so that we can go caving. And that's not the only reason the SCCI exists. There's also conservation and education, and recreation. Those are the three words in our mission. The conservation and education are a very large part as well. But we do own a few caves that are closed because of bats. And I'm proud of that as well. Frick's Cave, for one, is we open it one day a year. It does have some Civil War signatures and things in it, and people want to go see the cave. So it's open one day a year. Other than that, we leave it alone for the bats. And I'm proud of that, that the SCCI is doing those things as well, protecting caves for the animals that live there, not just for cavers to go enjoy.
Well, Steve Davis, this has been such a pleasure. I'm sure we could have talked for hours and hours and hours more, but I do appreciate this time that we've gotten, and keep at it, and hope we get to meet you sometime.
Well, yeah, if you're ever in TAG, you're more than welcome. I'd love to show you around. Yeah, it's great talking with you, Matt. Again, caving is my world. It's why I live here. And it's what I do. I'm caving, doing something cave related almost every day, which
awesome.
Is fun. And I didn't have mentioned at all my 16-year-old who has more caving experience, more vertical experience than most people in TAG. And he loves it as much as I do. And it's really exciting and thrilling just to be a dad and watching the son enjoy something that I'm so passionate about.
Oh, that's the dream for me. I got two boys, 1 and 3. And so we got a few more years before I can get them in a cave, but, yeah,
I started when he was 6. So, yeah. You only got 3 more years.
Oh, Steve, what an advocate for SCCI. I'll admit something to you. I was not a member of SCCI until an hour ago, less than an hour ago. I just signed up at the $50 a year level. You can be a sustaining member as well for as low as $5 a month. I didn't do that, but I did sign up for a little bit more. I think it's $35 a year for a basic membership, $50 a year if you just want to give a little more money. So that's what I did. All right, I'll just come clean. So I've got a link to the page that you need to go to join the SCCI. You can do it in less than a minute at saveyourcaves.org/join, and you can find that link in the description. Next month, Danielle Green, who is one of the directors of the Indiana Karst Conservancy. She's a great Indiana caver who's done an awful lot here. She's not really a project caver, but she loves caving, and she loves Indiana. And so we had such a great time just nerding out about Indiana caving, and I cannot wait for you to hear that on November the 1st. Again, we are now on Spotify. So if you like listening to podcasts on Spotify, you can check that out. That link is also in the description. Support the podcast by supporting our sponsors past and present. So right now, the current sponsor is El Spelio. Go to elspelio.com. Save $20 on any order of $300 or more, or when you buy any one of their headlamps. I got the Terra. I love it. You can also support Swego. They were once a sponsor of the podcast. Get a Swego pack at swegogear.com or Organic Robot on Etsy. Charlie is getting, he's opening up a shop in Greenfield, Indiana. How about all that? He's an expert screen printer and graphic designer, and you can order some stuff from him on the Etsy store, which is Organic Robot on Etsy. All one word, Organic Robot. Is that all? I think that's everything. All right. Have a good month. Until next time, kill nothing but time.